Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. This evening is Thursday, August 11th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Phipps. Oh, sorry, August 12th. And I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight we have money and markets, then a lot to do in precious metals with Franklin, and we're going to have questions with Franklin, so we're going to focus on precious metal questions. I wanted to mention we just took the report we published for subscribers last month, options for storage on precious metals, and we published it widely starting today. You can pick it up from the blog if you haven't had a chance to look at it. Well, a lot of tensions. We're coming into the fall, which traditionally I used to, when I worked in Washington, I used to call it the silly season, and we're seeing tensions rise. We're coming into an important congressional election, and yet we see repeated demonstration both in the polls. I talked about the Rasmussen poll last time, a real divergence between the political class and everyone else. We've seen Michelle Obama taking expensive vacations, Chelsea Clinton getting married at a very expensive sort of visible wedding, and the message again is pretty much, I think of that Michael Jackson song, "We Don't Care." They don't care about us, but we're really watching the political leadership evidencing a real spirit of they don't really need to think about, they don't need to care what the voters really think. We had Peggy Noonan write a very good article about America hitting a boiling point and the leadership really not caring. It's a very good one, and it's up on the blog. If there's any one sort of evidence of this real divergence between keeping up appearances or not keeping up appearances, it's the decision about whether or not to make Elizabeth Warren head of the new consumer agency. They have somebody who's very much an institutional player, law professor at Harvard, who's credible not only in terms of her institutional credentials, but is very much supported by the crowd and has done a great deal to educate people about the real financial problems in America and come up with solutions. There is real effort to stop her from being appointed, and if the administration doesn't, it's just another signal that they really feel like they do not need the support of the broad spectrum of America to govern. So that's going to make for a very tense fall, and this is really this is a time to take positive action for yourself or your local community or your networks and to keep your head down in terms of national politics, because it's the grinding of the gear is going to continue, but it's going to get a lot more tense this fall. And right at the heart of it is a big discussion about reforming housing, which could have a profound impact on both the housing and mortgage markets. We see Fannie and Freddie, which are now, along with the other federal agencies, making up 90% of the originations, asking for significant more subsidies. They're continuing to take losses. The Treasury is sponsoring a big conference next Tuesday on the future of the housing market, and the House has Barney Frank in the House has scheduled hearings in September, all sorts of indications that they're looking to radically re-engineer how the housing and mortgage market works, and it puts the whole market in flux because at this point the federal credit is the housing market. We have the Federal Reserve saying that as their mortgage markets, and they've been a big buyer in the last year given what they've been doing both on the bailouts and in the market, you have the Fed literally saying they're going to, as the mortgage securities mature, they're going to put the money in the Treasury market. So it's a lot to put the housing market in flux and the mortgage market. That's going to spill over in the municipal market. We haven't seen any discussion yet in the mainstream about the impact on municipal finances of continued softening in the housing market, but it's profound. During the housing bubble, a lot of the municipal financial structure depended on fees and other profits from active real estate market and from, of course, from property taxes. So watch for that to continue to spill in the municipal market. Really watching a revulsion as retail leaves the market, more and more information coming out about the 1,000-point drop and program trading and other things that compromise the integrity of the stock market in the small investor's mind. And obviously we were waiting for the Fed's announcements on Tuesday to see what would happen in the market. And sure enough, what we've seen is very significant drops. Not day before yesterday, and then of course today. In the Gulf, I put up a blog post called "Everything's Fine," and literally what we're seeing come out very much in concert between BP, the industry, and the government is continual saying everything's fine. Everything's fine, but we're still waiting for the relief wells, which we should hopefully know about next week. But clearly, as Dr. Ott talked about on the Saleri report, everything is not fine. So that story is still very important, even though clearly everything is being done to move it off the headlines. Another thing to watch is the argument at the FCC over net neutrality. There's a real effort to literally have a corporate takeover of the Internet. It could have profound consequences for all of it, and we've tried to keep following it up on the blog, but it's really something to watch, and it's very, very important because the Internet has really supported not only a much higher learning metabolism, but a lot of small business activity comes off the Internet, and if the corporations can compromise net neutrality, that's all going to change. I noticed Kiplinger had a very interesting little quip that I wanted to read to you. More than half of all small businesses are now run from owners' homes, and they're not just hobbies. 6.6 million of them supply 50% or more of household income. Two-fifths employ 2 to 5 people, 10% more than 5. One reason: technology, fast Internet connections, smartphones, and so on, making it easier to work from home while owners save big bucks not paying rent. So so you change net neutrality, and it could go right to the heart of the economics of that 6.6 million small businesses that supply 50% of more or of household income. Okay. I just wanted to mention something because you're watching more and more discussion around sovereign bond problems and around the problem of increasing debt in the economy. This is going to be an important story in the fall as people talk more and more about where is the safe fixed income, which government bonds are safe and which are not. We have numerous commentators saying that sovereign bonds are not as safe as they used to be. And I really want to make sure before we move into the fall that everyone who's a Saleri Report subscriber understand that there is no debt problem. And let me just step back and describe it. And it's really important that you understand this. If you have a group of political leadership who issues bonds and issues debt outside the Constitution, so illegally, and uses the money in illegal or covert ways, and then also uses money in legal ways, but ways that make money for them. So, for example, you issue bonds, you fund a whole group of contracts and activities that make sure a small group of players get their hands on lots of natural resources in other countries. Or as we talked about last week, you do job training for people in another country so you can swing contracts over and get cheap labor there. So if you use, you issue a huge amount of debt and you proceed to use that money in a way that makes money for private players but doesn't create a more productive economy, if anything, it can create a less productive economy. The problem is not that you have debt. The problem is you spent that debt in ways that were illegal and unproductive. And literally, if you look at some of the debt we have, if you add up all the debt that was not constitutionally issued, and so you could even argue that it was not a legal obligation of the United States or whatever sovereign government. So you add up all the debt that was not constitutionally issued. You add all the debt that could be offset by common law right of offset. So, for example, $4 trillion is missing from the federal government there are, in theory, ways of recapturing it by offset. So if you add it to that, and then you add it to debt that was issued for purposes that weren't in the best interest of the whole, you literally could be talking about all the debt, and that's not even mentioning the fact that much of the debt could have been funded not with debt but by the issuance of currency. In other words, we can finance public projects by simply issuing currency. We don't have to finance public projects by issuing debt that then basically cause the country to be drained. If you go to the blog, I did a wonderful little republication of Sam Smith's write-up of the Guernsey Islands financing of public projects by simply issuing currency. So if you look at all of the debt and you look at how that debt was issued, how it was used, on and on and on, we don't have a debt problem. We have a political problem. We have a governance problem. We have a system that creates debt for the benefit of something other than the whole. And that's the problem that needs to be addressed. So as we go into the fall and you hear more and more, we have a debt problem, Americans have been too profligate, they need to cut back, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and the solution to the debt problem is to cut this and this and this and that. What you have to remember is fundamentally you're being told something that starts with a lie. So I just want to bring that up. Okay, so there's so much going on in precious metals, I don't know where to start other than to turn to Franklin and say, well, Franklin, what's going on?
Well, what you're going to hear from me is something you've never expected to hear from me as long as you live, and that is, guess what's going up?
I know, but why don't you tell us?
The U.S. dollar, believe it or not. I've been watching the chart for some time, and I've come to the conclusion that the dollar's headed up. It's made a series of higher highs and higher lows, which is an uptrend. If you look at the last two moves up, they're five-wave moves. They're impulsive waves. The dollar came down from 88.70 to about 80, which is where its 200-day moving average was. And it looks like a market that's going higher. How high is it going? I don't know. It might go to 90. It might go to 92. It might even go higher than that. But there's no question in my mind that it appears to be headed up, and as long as it doesn't close below that 80, it's going up. Now, what is the dollar chart telling us? That's the question we have to ask. Maybe it's telling us that the euro is going to come apart. Maybe it's telling us that Europe is going to have a lot worse problems than the United States does. Maybe it's telling us that Japan or China or both are going to have worse problems than the United States.
I know. I was, I just showed this to you at dinner. I was stunned. As I was coming over here, I stopped and picked up the Wall Street Journal, today's journal, and let me just read it to everyone. Investors dumps, and this is at the very top of What's News, left-hand top, Wall Street Journal today. Investors dump stocks, commodities, and riskier currencies in a worldwide flight to safety amid worries over slowing growth. The Dow Industrials fell 265 points, or 2.5%, as all three major U.S. stock benchmarks moved to the red for the year. Traditional investor havens like the dollar, yen, treasuries, and gold strengthened. Now, for the Wall Street Journal to refer to gold as a traditional investor haven and put it on the top left said to me, you know, all the bells in the heavens rang. I couldn't wait to get to show you, but clearly what they're saying is there's a flight to safety and the dollar's going to benefit.
Well, I think that's correct. Now, the question remains for us, what is a rising dollar going to do to gold and silver? And I think you got the answer yesterday. The dollar rose 165 basis points. And to put that in perspective, you know, a 50 basis point day is a pretty big move. 165 is a huge, it's an enormous move. And what happened to gold? Well, nothing much happened to gold. Gold really didn't go anywhere. In other words, gold was not trashed. Gold was actually up a few dollars, and silver was down 16 cents or so, 26 cents. But the point is, they were not trashed. The stock market was trashed.
Right.
Now, what's a little bit difficult to understand in this is why the dollar would go up, basically on news out of the Federal Reserve, that they are going to continue to inflate and probably inflate a lot more. The, you know, the logic and the plan from their Tuesday statement is a little bit difficult to parse. They've got a lot of mortgage bonds on their balance sheet, and as the bonds are paid off, as the principal on the bonds are paid off, or maybe we should say if the principal on the bonds is paid off, they're planning on rolling that over into treasury bills. Well, or treasury debt. That is not in itself inflationary, right? That does not in itself create new dollars. But it sure doesn't shrink the money supply either. And the other things that the Fed said seem to indicate that they think that the economy is wallowing in problems and inflation is the only cure to get us out. And, of course, there might be a deflation scare on the horizon. Well, you know, back to our original, our long-held presupposition, the Fed does not exist to do but two things. The first is to inflate, and the second is to manage inflation expectations.
Right.
And so every once in a while in the course of managing inflation expectations, they need a deflation scare so that the realizers will get out of the dollar more slowly than they otherwise would. So this is, you know, I think the signal, the way I interpret the signal is that the Fed is going to inflate as necessary. Now, apparently the gold market is not afraid of that. The gold market said, fine with us. And today the gold market followed through with a $17 rise that brought it above 1,200 resistance, above 1,210 resistance, and all the way up to the $1,215, $1,218 resistance. The way that chart looks like it is headed up. There's no question about that. Then if I back off of the five-day chart and look at a longer-term chart, all that's happened with both silver and gold is they bumped down on the bottom channel line, the uptrend line. That's not unusual. They're not in the middle of long-term corrections like the giant correction that we saw in the fall of 2008. They're in the middle of uptrends. And the uptrends are far from complete. In fact, they've basically just begun. So unless you see gold go below 1150, 1155, I think was the recent low, and silver go below $17, we're in an upward mode, and you're going to see higher prices as we move into the fall. Now, tentatively right now, it looks like to me that probably sometime in the spring of 2011, we will see a significant high in gold. Now, that doesn't mean the end of the bull market, but it does mean we'll see a significant high, and that might be $1,350, $1,375. It might be $1,600.
You had a wonderful article that I posted on the resource section for this Solari report at the control panel, so all the subscribers can get it. And it was on the highs and lows in the last 10 years, and I was wondering maybe if you could go through what the seasonal patterns have been over the last 10 years and what it might mean to this fall.
Well, you know, the logic of that was this, that when you look at a seasonal pattern, usually a seasonal chart is drawn from like 35 or 40 years of trading activity, and what you see out of that is that there are certain seasonal items, seasonal forces that drive a market up and down, like for instance, you would expect for grain prices to go down in the summer before the new harvest is made, and to go up in the summer and then to go down in the fall when the new harvest comes in, because obviously supply is changing. And silver is the same way. Silver and gold are the same way. But what I was trying to do was to take out all of those years when silver and gold were in bear markets, to see how it behaved. And the astonishing thing is that if you just look at the yearly highs and yearly lows, we don't get new yearly highs and lows in the summer and early fall months. In other words, June, July, August, and September, we get no gold lows and only one silver low. So what that says to me is that that implies or strengthens my interpretation that what you're seeing now, we've seen the bottom of a correction and gold and silver starting to move up again. And then most of the highs in silver, the yearly highs, occur in December.
I was surprised by that. I had not expected it to be. I had expected it to be October, November, and I hadn't realized it was December was the highest point.
And almost the end of December. That's except for one. There's 6 out of 9 years that the highs are in. 5 out of those years, the highs are in December, and one of them has a low has a high about the 26th of November. Now the cyclical highs are not quite the same. The cyclical highs fall in the first half of the year, and 2 out of 3 of them fall in the first quarter of the year, as a matter of fact. So February, March, and May have seen the cyclical highs. And by cyclical highs, what I mean is a move from a new low to a new high. And those will run 15, 18 months or more. But if you just look at yearly highs and low, most of the yearly highs fall in December. And what that tells us is that there's a very, very strong seasonal pattern for highs for a rising gold market and silver toward the end of the year. So you're really moving. It would take a lot of forces moving against us to see much lower gold prices the rest of the year. I'm not saying it's not possible, but it's unlikely.
Well, I get back to my calling the fall in Washington the silly season.
Mm-hmm.
When I did the year end wrap up at the beginning of the year, I said this year would be like the grinding of the gears, and there's a lot to grind through in the new federal budget. It's going to get very ugly. I don't know whether you saw the story of literally the one of the housing authorities in Atlanta decided to redo its waiting list for Section 8 housing vouchers and ended up with 30,000 people waiting hours to sign up to be on a waiting list. So you're talking about, just incredible pressures. The federal budget's going to get finalized for October 1st. And if you look at all the money that's looking for a safe haven, Franklin, gold is such a tiny market, and you have so many different players looking to move in. I just don't see where the argument is for gold to drop this fall. And I think, and I don't think it's really, I don't think this is really about markets. I think this is really about people being shocked at the lawlessness of what we're watching, and this feeling of really non-caring by the leadership and saying, where can I put my money that I feel is safe?
Well, it's a matter of alternatives.
Right.
They're looking at the alternatives. And you made a statement tonight at supper that was very insightful to me, and that is the money that's flowing into gold is not coming out of the dollar necessarily.
Uh-uh.
I mean, and we saw that in the last 6 months when there was a huge rally in the euro gold price. Not so much in gold. I mean, gold didn't do badly, but not like it did in the euro. And so, you've got the euro, you've got the whole Chinese bomb that never has gone off yet. And I think you and I have talked about this, that it's just contrary to intuition and logic that a communist country would be the economic leader of the world. I mean, I just have difficulty digesting that, considering that the only thing that they produced successfully in the 20th century was shortages. So I continue to get rumors about huge Chinese overbuilding. I had a friend, who built turnkey corrugated box plants, and he reported building a couple of box plants in China where there was no demand at all. They were out in the middle of nowhere. They built this huge, multi-million-dollar box plant, and no demand, no apparent use for it. There are cities that they built that there's nobody there. There are malls. There's a huge, huge overbuilding, probably overblown twice as much as the U.S. real estate bubble was.
Right.
In China right now. Well, that's going to burst at some point. And when it does, there's going to be more flight capital that's running out of all of those declining assets and trying to find a refuge somewhere else.
So I think what they're doing with taking the wages up, I mean, you're literally watching the wages in China rise.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all part of this rebalancing from the U.S. consumer to the Asian consumer and the emerging markets consumer. So I think they're going to try and offset it with rising wages.
But they've got to have some rising demand. I mean, somebody has to buy the stuff.
Right.
But in any event, there will be a bomb there at some point. And you're right. They're trying to rebalance, but there will be a bomb at some point in which all of that malinvestment from the state-run economy appears. And the state banks have huge debts that have just not been recognized.
Right. Well, the problem of running a bubble as opposed to something which is in alignment with a real economy
mm-hmm.
is a problem that's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just here. It's everywhere. And so the misallocation of capital is everywhere, which takes us to our topic, near and dear to my heart, of localization. I posted for everyone a video. I put it up two weeks ago, and then reposted it in the Precious Metals blog post. It's 10 minutes. I really hope you watch it. It is of the Muslim community in Indonesia who's now making and using gold and silver coins. And there's a wonderful scene with a young man who in 2000, I think he opened a bank account and was using a local currency and then realized, this is not working for me, and switched to gold and silver. And there's one wonderful scene where he's eating his noodles and they're talking about how much the currency is being debased and how people are being hurt and people are losing money. And he basically said, well, that's too bad, but what do I care? I'm fine. I thought, no, that's the best single ad I've ever seen for sitting down and figuring out how we could, how we could learn to use alternative currencies, and the obvious one is let's just start liquefying our precious metals. So let's start with localization. You made this wonderful speech down in Mississippi, and I put the audio up in the blog, and we've been passing it everywhere. And maybe if you could just go through some of the key highlight points that you made about sort of what are some of the issues that we have to think about when we start to build a local economy, because if we're all going to pull all of our money out of the stock market and we want income and jobs, then it's all going to come back to how do we start to rebuild our local economies.
Well, it has to start there, because the reason that we're not the only reason, I mean, the monetary system is obviously part of the mechanism, but our economy 100 years ago was not actually a national economy in the same sense it is today, where the milk I drink every day comes from California. Actually, my milk comes from Tennessee, but most people's milk comes from California or Florida, and there are no dairies left in Tennessee. We didn't have an economy like that. We had a nation of local economies where we took care of each other's daily needs, and then there was some national traffic. But from about 1917 forward, that economy, those local economies were co-opted, and the lifeblood, the circulation, the money that used to circulate in them has been sucked out and sent to a national centralized economy. Now, formerly, what happened was that the farmer grew food, and he took the food to town and sold it, and he sold it to the hardware store owner and the tailor and the baker and all of these other people. And they, in turn, eventually the money came back to the farmer because they had to buy food from him again. And you had a local circulation of money. People didn't have a terrible lot of money, but they didn't need a lot of money because most of them were self-sufficient farmers, raised what they needed. But there was a local economy with a local circulation. The nationalization of the economy, the national centralization of the economy, just like a vacuum cleaner or like a vampire, probably is a better way to put it, sucked all of that circulating money out of the economy. So now today we're left in this situation, so where every year all the people in my county have to go outside the county somewhere and find money and bring it back so they can spend it at Walmart and McDonald's, and Walmart and McDonald's can send it off to Bentonville and New York, and then we can start and do the whole thing all over again, because none of the money stays here to enrich the local economy and to keep the local economy prosperous. So what we have to do is to break that cycle and get a local flow of cash going around amongst the participants in the economy. And it's, you know, I know that this is difficult. I know this is a big hurdle for people to stop thinking in terms of Walmart and start thinking in terms of their neighbor. But it is possible. And the cost of it is not immediately seen in the price. There's a far greater cost in terms of, let me say, human equity or human health that we ignore when we buy food at Walmart. I mean, if you want to know what the true cost of Walmart food is, and the food American style that is grown through a centralized economy, then go down to stand in front of any Walmart and look at the people coming in and out. Look at all the people who are so sick that they have to ride in those little go-karts, you know, the little electric go-karts. They're sick, they have diabetes, they have high blood pressure, they have heart disease, they have all these illnesses and autoimmune disease because of the food they eat. I mean, I know that's not the only reason, but that's the major reason.
Right.
So that's the cost that you're not counting. So when you see that chicken for 49 cents a pound and you think it's a good buy, it's not a good buy. That 49 cents is only part of the cost. So I think the key is to getting people to work with local farmers to buy their food locally and getting them to understand, hey, we're not just talking about the money here. We're talking about community. We're talking about helping your neighbor. And we're talking about your own health and your longevity. And all of those things are part of prosperity. You know, prosperity is not just my being rich and able to drive a Cadillac past the slums.
There are also some risk issues, which is, you know, who do you want to depend on for your food? Because, and it's not just safety, it's the food can get cut off. Who do you trust to continue the food flow to you?
Right. And even if it weren't a matter of trust, it is a matter of risk, because it's 1,200 miles or 2,000 miles out to California from here, and it's only 10 miles out to my local dairy.
Right.
So, yeah, sure, that's part of it.
Now, one of the things you go through in the localization presentation, which I think is not well understood, is the extent to which small farms are put out of business, not by economics, but by fiddling with the rules by state and local government regulation.
Well, state and local government regulation is what keeps them from being profitable, if that's what you're thinking about. Because let me give you an example. I mean, the best example is the example you can see driving down the highway. I don't know about the rest of the country. I know about Tennessee. You can't go 30 miles in Tennessee that you don't see the gravestones of dead dairies. And by that, what I mean is silos. Silos, and maybe there's a crumbling milking barn there. Now, why in the world, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, were there so many silos in Tennessee? And the answer is because farmers could make a good living milking 8, 10, 15 cows in a little operation like that and selling the milk to their neighbors. It's just that simple. But the laws, the regulations that prevent them from selling raw milk are exactly what keep farmers from prospering. And then if you add to that the indoctrination that they receive from the Extension Service and the agricultural agencies that say, oh, you've got to get big or get out, you've got to use these herbicides and pesticides, you've got to use GMO foods and so forth. I mean, I love some of the people in some of the ag agents that I know, and they're really well-intentioned people. But that whole industry is fed one way, and that is chemicals and high-input agriculture. And farmers are slowly decapitalized doing that. They lose a little more money year after year until finally they have to go out of business. But it's the same way with let me give you another example of regulations. When we moved here 11 years ago, we went to a processor, a meat processor, to have pigs and cows processed. And he went out of business in about 6 months. He was an older guy, and you know, he didn't have any children that wanted to take over his business. We've been through 9 processors since then.
Good Lord.
And now, in order to build a new processing facility, that is one that's not grandfathered in, would cost about $1.5 million.
Right.
Well, who can afford that?
Right.
I mean, not these folks around here. They don't.
You have to generate a lot of profits to just finance that out of retained earnings.
Oh, of course you do.
Yeah.
And it can't be done. So there again, you've got an example. Chickens is another example. And the USDA actually has an exemption for 20,000 birds. That is, you can process 20,000 birds on your own place. They don't want to know about it. They don't want to inspect you. They don't want to have anything to do with it. You're too small for them to fool with. Well, in Alabama, the way that's interpreted is you can kill 20,000 birds on your own place, and that's okay. In Tennessee, you can't kill one bird. Now, what does that mean? Here's what it means. There's about a 50% profit margin for that on that bird for a farmer. So if he can grow 5,000 birds a year, that's about $25,000 profit to his bottom line. Now, believe me, he earns it. It's hard work. It's hard work processing the animals. It's hard work raising them. But when he gets finished, he has the most superb and nourishing food product that you can imagine. Well, you've eaten them. You know how good they are.
Yeah, I buy your chickens.
Right. So, I mean, they're that good. So the point here is that there's another profit center that farmers could avail themselves of, but they can't because the state won't let them. And in various other states, you know, there are all kinds of crazy things. Like eggs, you know, what difference does it make about how eggs are handled? The truth is eggs will actually not go bad for about 2 or 3 weeks if you keep them in just a reasonably cool place, not in a refrigerator. Wash the egg off if you want to, but why can't you sell eggs, you know? And some states have regulations against that. And then all kinds of the added value stuff like, you know, jams, jellies, relishes, the things that you can cook in a home kitchen, you know, make money on. All of those things are forbidden. And it just comes back to the same point that finally dawned on me. All regulation, and I mean all health regulation, all regulation by the state aims at stifling competition.
Right.
All of it.
It's all been designed to centralize control of markets.
Right. That's exactly right. And so what we have to do is decentralize. And if conceptually the key is to decentralize, what we have to do is roll back regulations. We have to undo regulations, and in a lot of cases, we're going to have to undo a century of prejudices because most of this stuff has been sold as having health benefits, right? We have to protect your health. Well, let me tell you something. I'll take my risks with raw milk. I will not take my risks with pasteurized, homogenized milk.
Right.
And it's the same way with any number of food products. The proof of my argument that or one proof of my argument that all regulation aims to stifle competition is the FDA. In the period right before 1910, there was all kinds of publicity about how food processors were adding all these poisonous additives to their food and so forth, and there was the poison squad where this scientist got together 20 young men and he fed them food with additives for 3 months and they all got sick, and they parlayed all that into the FDA. All right? The Pure Food and Drug Act. Well, now guess, since 1905, guess how many additives have been forbidden to be put into food by the FDA?
I don't know.
100? 80? Zero.
Zero.
Not one. Zero. Zero. So.
Okay, so I'm going to jump for a second to investment dollars and government money and then come back to precious metals and how it fits into localization, because if you look at the money that would be needed to finance, let's say, a mobile slaughterhouse or to finance a feed mill or any of the other things that you need to really start to grow the local food movement, part of the problem is we put all of our money into big banks and brokerage accounts and ship it all to Wall Street. So it's not just the food business that's been centralized. It's been the bank deposits and the investments. And literally, there's a wonderful scene in the another video I put up on the blog called Time for Change about entrepreneurs around the world who are trying to sort of localize money. And the commentator said, you know, people can either trust the banks or each other, and they hate the banks, but they don't trust each other. And so part of this is, how do we build ways of flowing our money locally that, you know, because we've got it as we bring the food purchases back and the food production and distribution, we've got to bring the money back too.
Right. Well, that's, we have to create local investment flows as well as local consumption flows.
Right.
And there's no question about this, Catherine. That's going to be harder to do than just handing your money over to some fellow with a mutual fund.
Right.
Of course it is. Is there more risk? I don't think there's more risk, because you're there to watch whoever this is that you're loaning money to, and you can go down once a week and say, well, how, you know, how's business been this week, and find out for yourself and look at the financial statements. But you don't know, when you give your money to some money manager in New York, you don't know if he's got a problem with his wife, if he drinks too much, or what. You have no idea of knowing what he's going to do. So we have to bend those local money flows and get them to come back. Is there a problem with return on equity? I don't believe so, because the average small business in the United States has a 20% return. Now, out of 20%, if you went into business with somebody, that would amortize your investment pretty quickly.
Well, but here's the thing. If you run a dollar through a publicly traded stock, you get a multiple of 10 or 20 times earnings, and it's liquid. If you run it through private equity, it's not liquid, and you get a multiple that's much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the question is, can we create ways of creating liquidity? It's not going to get as much as a big corporate stock necessarily right now, but can we create ways that make it more liquid and give it the professional management? Because just like we're shipping our food purchases and our money to Wall Street, the most valuable commodity we have is our human capital, and we're shipping our talented kids out. You know, around here, the kids are either going to Iraq or they're going to prison, or we're shipping them up to Harvard, and then they go to Wall Street and they never come back. So another part of this is keeping the human capital and financing the human capital to build back the infrastructure. Now, let me just bring up one other thing, because I, as you know, I've got a bugaboo about government money. If you look at the sources and uses of money within a place, everybody's paying taxes to the federal, state, and local governments, and then that tax dollar is going to corporations. So, for example, if you look at the school or prison or other institutional food purchases in a place, you know, they're buying food from outside the community. They're not spending our tax dollars locally. We're literally, you know, my old friend, my example in Tennessee, where we have 20-25% unemployment rates in a county, but the data servicing jobs on the food stamps is being outsourced to JPMorgan Chase in India, and that's the state's choice. So there's a huge amount of jobs that can literally be engineered back with our tax dollars if we don't let the government money flow out. But that comes back to this, you know, when you said you got to change the rules, that's more of the rules we got to change.
Right, exactly. And that, you know, in this case, I'm really not much in favor of rules, as I'm sure you know. But in this case, I don't see anything wrong with a rule that says if you buy food for a prison, for a school, et cetera, it has to come from Tennessee, or you have to prove you can't get it from Tennessee. You know.
So okay,
if
so they let's
want to
come
serve
back
avocados,
to precious metals, because tell me why precious metals, how precious metals fits into relocalization.
Well, you know that everybody knows Gresham's law: bad money drives good money out of circulation. What people don't understand is that's only true in the presence of legal tender laws. When people are forced to use the bad money and to take the bad money, then they won't spend the good money. They'll hoard that and take that out of circulation. And we've seen that work on a giant scale with silver and gold. They've been forced out of circulation by the Fed and the whole paper money scheme. So what if we can start a local circulation of silver? Because and gold too, like your people in Indonesia. The thing is, that is a circulation that will stay where we are. It can't be sent to New York Walmart doesn't want to take your gold or silver in exchange for whatever they've got, but the local people who you do business with will be glad to. Not only will they be glad to do it, but it is also a superior money to the paper money because it will be gaining in value all the time. So once we can start a local circulation of silver and gold in a community, that circulation will stay there. And one of the advantages of that is we're taking this dead capital that's buried in somebody's basement or locked away in their safe deposit box or safe, which is their gold and silver, and we're mobilizing that capital and putting it to work in the economy as a circulation. That's what we ultimately have to do. Now, the thing is, this is perfectly legal. This is not illegal. There's legal tender U.S. silver coin and gold coin that can be used to do this. The problem is everybody's ignorant. They don't know anything about that. That's, how do I know that's a silver dime? And that, you know, you get questions like that. Well, the way you know is by looking. The way you know.
Well, but how, I've tried in where I live to get people interested, and of course they just look at me like I'm nuts.
Well, you know how to get them.
Uh-huh.
Here's the way to get them. Get you some old coal silver dollars. You know, those are the ones that are really worn. And the girl comes to you and she's got a $15 bill or $18 bill at the diner, and you hold out $18 in paper and you hold out one silver dollar, and you say, which one of these do you want? And you'll get a few of them that'll say, oh, I don't know what that silver dollar's worth. Most of them will say, I'll take the silver one.
Really?
Oh, I guarantee you they will. Yeah, there's something magical about silver dollars.
Uh-huh.
And they're right now they'll cost you about 18 bucks or so. So, you know, all I know is you just have to keep trying and exposing people to it. Or you can do the same thing with silver rounds. And people will really, you know, they'll go for it. But you just have to ask them. You just have to ask.
Well, I feel like it's coming, and I do think it is absolutely critical, because unless you have a sound currency to transact with each other, and unless you have the kind of capital that comes from transacting, so maybe you do some barter and other things as well, unless you have that way of pricing things that has some honesty to it, then it's hard for these other things to happen. What I've seen in every community is people constantly getting tricked back into the centralized system. So I'll give you a perfect example that just happened. Slow Money is a group that came out of the socially responsible venture capital area, and they're interested in financing lots of food initiatives. And they just came out with a big paper that they had written with a funding of a big foundation. And it was on how they could get financing to start food businesses. And I opened this thing with much anticipation. And basically what it said is, we're going to go to the SBA and Treasury and the government and get financing. And I almost fell out my chair, because what they're saying is, we're going to go to the people who changed the rules that made us not profitable and ask them to help us and enter into complex transactions with them that gives them lots of power to make crazy with us and put us out of business. I mean, why would you do that? But once again, you know, we're kind of tricked, you know, people that have the right idea and are headed in the right direction get tricked back into the old system. And so, but part of the issue is, as you're dealing with all these different things, how can you not get tricked or bought back? You know, all you need to do is buy back a few people and you can hiccup an incredible effort.
Well, you know, the problem with those people is they never learned and are not remembering the one fundamental law of the universe. And the one fundamental law of the universe is all government money comes with a sock in the jaw.
Right.
That's it. I don't care how good it looks, it's always going to end up being a sock in your jaw. And it'll come just at the time when you're not looking to. So.
Well, part of it is, you know, what this is all about is not about, you know, it's not about money. It's about freedom. And who's going to control my mind, my body, my equity, my data, my health, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really about, am I free or not? And to me, it's critical, if we want to be free, that we withdraw our economic transactions from those who wish us to not be free. And so to do that, you've got to see, okay, who wants me to not be free, and how do I withdraw from that person? Because unless we withdraw, you know, we're literally financing. And we're financing the very thing that's killing us.
But are you willing to pay the price?
Right. And so to me, it's really funny, because when I saw this in 1999 and I said, okay, I'm going to figure out how to withdraw as much as possible, you know, I'm going to stop reading and buying the media as much as I can. I'm going to switch my bank deposits. I'm going to switch my investments. I'm going to switch who I associate with and my friends. You know, it's a learning journey. It goes on and on and on. But as part of that, I was very clear that being, you know, there were two teams and I was on one team, and doing business with the other team was not a function of price. You know, I'm always laughing because every week I get another mailing from Citibank. I have for years. I get one almost every week. And every week it offers me more frequent flyers than the last to sign up for a Citibank credit card. And I really expect that the day before I die to get a mailing from Citibank and says, we will give you $1,005,456,000 frequent flyer miles if you'll just take the Citibank credit card. And my answer is no. I'm not going to take a Citibank credit card for any amount of money ever. You know, I'd rather die. So, but because to me it's not a function of price. And so what I've never understood, Franklin, is how do you communicate that? How do you communicate that that's the first decision that needs to be made by a critical mass of people if we're going to build a local economy?
You know, Catherine, really what you're talking about is making the decision that you're going to live free or die. And if
it's very New Hampshire.
Huh? I know. Well, I know. I don't mind stealing it from them, even if they're Yankees. Because in this case, they're absolutely right. And you just have to make up your mind, are you willing to pay the price? If you're not, then go on and put on the leg irons and stop complaining.
Right.
You know, I had a fellow today. I was on another radio program this afternoon. And this fellow called up from Florida, and he was moaning and groaning about how lazy everybody was and how they all wanted to get on the government tit and all that. And I just stopped him. I said, wait, it doesn't do a bit of good to talk about how awful everything is. The only thing that helps is for you to change it. And you're not right anyway, because everybody is not lazy. My experience talking, and I'll bet you've seen the same thing. I talk to people all over the country every day. And my experience is that they're just as honest and upstanding as they can be.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Mean, as far as the supposed, you know, depreciation of the American character, people are wrong about that, because there are a whole bunch of them out there who are just as upstanding and hardworking as their parents and grandparents were. But the problem is they're trapped too.
Right.
You know, and unless we somehow work together, it's just going to get worse, and you work together by saying, we're going to work together, whatever the cost is, and I'm going to pay it, because the cost is worth it.
My heroes for the week are the founders of the what's called the Happiness Bank in Estonia, and you can see it's sort of a barter exchange of helping each other with sort of, it's good deeds, but, you know, I help you wash your car, and you watch my kids, and, you know, it's a beautiful example of two talented people in a down economy saying, well, we may be unemployed, but we're just going to turtle forward anyway. What can we get done with what we have? And it's a perfect example of what we need to be doing this fall instead of worrying about, you know, exactly what crazy next thing they're going to do, because that's going to build the pathway. You know, we're going to have to turtle forward. And we're going to have to keep turtling forward trying to build our local economies, because that's where the, you know, where the shift has got to happen. And it's, you know, each of us is just going to have to focus on those pieces which are energizing for us to do. But they are there, and there's, you know, I love the permaculture expression, problem equals opportunity.
Well, that's true.
Because if you look at what could happen if all the wealth that's being destroyed in a local place, if you reverse that and that wealth starts to be destroyed, there's incredible wealth that can be created. And that's income, that's equity, that's jobs for us. I encourage everybody, if you didn't watch Time for Change, it's a wonderful video, and at the end of it is the section which is the description of the currency in Indonesia. Well, let's turn, Franklin, to the last piece we wanted to talk about, which is the our next date in the top 10 dates. And we thought we'd talk about the creation of the Federal Reserve, but in fact that's such a big deal that what we decided to do is split it up into several sections, and we're going to start today with the historical context of the Federal Reserve. So maybe if you could walk us through coming into the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, what are sort of the key historical issues that are the backdrop to this enormous development?
Can I go back to 1678?
Yes, sir.
Because the first fiat money or paper money that appeared in the United States in the colonies appeared there in Massachusetts when they had tried to carry out warfare against the Massachusetts sent a military expedition of militia against Canada, which was held by the French at that time, and the whole thing came to nothing. But they had to pay the men, and they floated the first issue of paper money. And from there, it became the issuance of paper money by all of these independent colonies became a nightmare because they all issued money at different rates. That meant it depreciated at different rates, and you had all of this currency circulating, and nobody knew what it was really worth, and people were constantly being gypped and cheated. And so by the time that you got to the American Revolution, it was a huge problem. The Continental Congress made the problem worse by issuing a similar currency, the Continental, which depreciated massively during the war because they never put any backing behind it. They didn't try to put any backing behind it. They just issued more paper money when they needed it. So you have this whole history. You have 100 years of experience with the perils of fiat money, and then comes the Constitutional Convention. The Constitutional Convention was called in part because of this crisis that the fiat money had created. There couldn't be any commerce between the states because there was no way to pay for the commerce. There were all these differing bills. So what the Constitution did was it took from the states the ability to make anything except gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. It didn't strip them of their ability to name a tender altogether. It just said, if you do it, you have to make it gold and silver. And that was interpreted during the period from then until the beginning of the war between the states. There were a number of court cases where states tried to operate state banks, or they tried to issue warrants or paper money or whatever it was. And the Supreme Court universally said, you can't do that. The only money in this country, the only way to pay a debt is not with banknotes of any kind, but with gold or silver coin. So all of that history is behind what happened in 1861 and 62. When the war began, Lincoln needed a network to finance the bonds to finance the war, and so in 1862 they set up the embryonic Federal Reserve. This is the embryo that became the center of the Federal Reserve, and that is the Greenback Act and with that the National Banking Act that created a cartel of national banks and basically tried to put all the state banks out of business. It certainly put them out of the money creating business. So you had already had a centralization take place in 1862. There had always, now to go back again to the end of the Revolution, the ink was not dry on the Constitution before conspirators were plotting how they were going to get a central bank in the United States. Because remember, by that time, the Bank of England was already 100 years old, so they knew how profitable it was. And they tried with the first bank, Bank of North America, and then with the first bank, uh, first First Bank of the United States and the Second Bank of the United States. So, see, all of these things were issues, the issue of a central bank, the problem of banking and banking as a parasite on the economy. These were all lively political issues, and all of the money issues were all lively political issues right up until the war between the states.
Right, and in fact, the population was much more knowledgeable about them.
Oh, incredibly. It's astonishing. I mean, if you really want to feel ignorant, go and read some of those court cases where these judges, who obviously are, you know, lawyers, actually have this deep philosophical understanding of how money, of the mechanics of the economic mechanics of money. So you have all of those things going on that go into the pie with the Federal Reserve. After the war, what the war did was it created an extremely powerful cartel of rich people. There were people who made vast fortunes off financing and supplying the war. And this had never existed before in the United States. You know, DuPont was just a sleepy little powder manufacturer, one of many in the North. Well, they became enormous, so enormous that by 1905, they could split the entire world up with Imperial Chemical and say, okay, everything on this side of the line, all the countries on this side of the line, we're going to sell gunpowder to, and you can sell to all the people on that side of the line. They literally split the world in two. But it was the same way with finance, that the banks became immensely powerful. So that after the war, the banks had bought with paper money government bonds, and the bonds were supposed to be paid back the same way. Instead, they got the Credit Strengthening Act passed in 1868, which said that not only the interest but also the principal on the bonds would be paid in gold. Well, what that meant was that the bonds, the bankers were net bondholders in that period post-war period, and they initiated several different acts that deflated the currency. Well, you know what happens when you have a deflation? The value of each unit of currency rises.
Right.
So the not only the interest but also the principal that the bondholders recovered grew in value and purchasing power. Meanwhile, the whole country was locked into this deflation. I mean, there would be a post-war depression anyway, because when you remove all of that demand, it takes a few years for the economy to readjust. So there was a post-war depression, and then there were hard times literally from then until the early 1890s. And then, as we talked about in another segment, silver was demonetized, which further decreased the money supply. So the lines were drawn by 1905, 1900, and there was a huge anti-banking party in the United States, the populists. You know, and of course, now when everybody says the word populist, they sneer, but the populists were trying to somehow or the other counterbalance the power, the economic power that the banks had over the people. And so one of those things was bimetallism, and they were against a central bank. But you had the Panic of 1907, and that was put forward with a lot of other window dressing, like this big commission that was sent over to Europe to investigate central banking in Europe and all of that sort of stuff. And they produced a 7-volume report that nobody ever read, except for the last line, which said, we need a central bank. So this is the background to central banking in the United States, and there was huge opposition to a central bank, and that's the reason why the Banking Act, the Federal Reserve Act, was passed in the final hours before Christmas in 1913, when nobody was there except the proponents of the bill. So the other representatives and senators weren't there to vote against the Federal Reserve Act.
Okay, well, next month we'll go into the creation and the passage of the Act and the creation of the Federal Reserve. Well, Franklin, thank you very much. That's it for this evening's Precious Metals Report. Coming up next week, we have Victor Maher from the University of Pennsylvania,
and we're going to be talking about his translation and interpretation of the work, Sun Tzu, The Art of War. It's a fascinating book. The reason I wanted to do The Art of War is one of the questions at the CART was, what are the best books for the next millennium? I first started to read, I read The Art of War when I was in college, but when I was in the litigation, I kept sort of crossing paths with various people from the intelligence community, and one of the first questions they would that would come out of their mouth was, oh, you need to read The Art of War. I finally, you know, I can't really swear to you that this is a, you know, the manual at the CIA and NSA, but, you know, you started to wonder, there was great faith in the philosophy and wisdom of The Art of War, so it's clearly one of the books, and it's one I read many times and enjoy reading, so we're going to talk with arguably the top expert in the country. We had the wonderful Mike Linton do a lot of research on who's really the best in the country on The Art of War and then run this professor down, so it ought to be very good. So, ladies and gentlemen, again, check out that article on the storage options if you haven't. And until next week, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.